everyone. My name is Pastor Dennis, one of the pastors on staff here. It's good to be back with you. We're just back from our holidays, and it was a glorious time spending time with family and grandchild, number one. More to come, I'm sure, but it's good to be home. We are continuing with our study in the book of Romans, and we're picking up on the Apostle Paul's letter to Romans. And Pastor Kyle has been taking us through this book, this letter, and it is very complex, it is very dense, there is a lot of great challenging teaching here from Paul, and we're going to jump into it again. We have been most recently in chapter 9, and this morning we will be at the beginning of chapter 10. So if you have your Bibles with you, in whatever form, I'll ask you to pull those out now and turn there to the end of chapter 9, beginning of chapter 10. And as always, we have Bibles at the back. If you need one, feel free to help yourself to one of those, and you can keep it. It's our gift to you, so they're available on the table at the back of the auditorium. Last Sunday, Kyle tackled that great apparent contradiction between whether or not we choose God or God chooses us. Whether we have the free will to be saved or if God decides who will be saved and who will not. And I thought he did an excellent job demonstrating the priority of God's work in our salvation. God is the ultimate chooser, the mover, the activator, and agent in our coming to God and to knowing the grace and mercy of God's saving work. What I think Kyle was getting us in touch with was this awesome, sobering, humbling reality that God is sovereign in all things, even in salvation. And the way I like to think of it is this: there's some way in which God's will is sovereignly done in our lives while still preserving and allowing the ability and the responsibility for us to choose Him. I say that in that way because I see both of these truths in Scripture. And how they fit together exactly, I can't say, but I trust that the God who parted the Red Sea, the God who covered my sin, and the God who raised the dead has found a way. And so we live in this tension, trying to reconcile God's love with His holiness, His justice with His mercy, our choosing with God's choosing. And Kyle's admission in the end, if you were here, you may recall, was that he didn't understand completely how this works. I mean, who does? I don't. But Kyle's call, and I believe it's Paul's call ultimately as well here, is for us to embrace this mystery, to be enthralled by the fact that this God would show mercy to us at all, and that He would save us when we do not deserve it, and that He would do it in a way that preserves His sovereignty and His justice, and His holiness. I want to be perfectly frank with you. Passages like this scare me. They frighten me. God, in my experience, can get so familiar to us, can't He? He becomes a fixture in the background of our lives, and we kind of start to assume things about God. We presume upon Him. We take it for granted that He's there, that He loves us, that everything He does is going to be good for us, and that He will act in a way that we expect. He's kind of our buddy, you know, in the background there. And we do feel a closeness to Him, and that's good. That's a good thing, and rightly so. But then I read a passage like this, and I am reminded that God is God, and I am not. That His ways are far above my ways. That His thoughts are far above my thoughts. And in reading this passage, we approach, I think, the greatness of God. I'm not talking about an earthly greatness. I'm not talking about applauding a great athlete as we marvel at his or her physical accomplishments. I'm not talking about the greatness of an intellect or a teacher as we marvel at his or her ability to reason. I'm not talking about applauding a great diplomat as we admire his or her ability to manage the political issues of the day. This is more like encountering divine greatness, the way the prophet Isaiah did when he saw the Lord on his throne and he declared, "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King of the Lord of hosts." That's the kind of greatness that I think we are seeing in this passage. And I want to talk about that kind of greatness a little bit today. For I believe that part of what Paul is ultimately trying to do in this letter to the Romans is illustrate to his readers the awesome, the terrible, the fearsome, and the wondrous greatness of Jesus Christ. You know, there's a kind of greatness that I believe we need to see today, and this is it. And that's because in our culture, we have a steady diet of pretenders to greatness. Everyone, it seems, wants to be seen as being great at something. Have you ever noticed that? Reality TV, personal blogs, athletic contests, everywhere you look, there are people saying, "Look at how great I am. Look at what I've accomplished. Look at what is great about me and my life." And we seem to be in this constant quest to celebrate something. We're constantly finding new ways in which winners can be declared and greatness can be achieved. And sometimes I wonder about some of those. About 3 years ago, Jill Caratini, who is now the managing editor of a website called A Slice of Infinity, which is a ministry associated with Ravi Zacharias, reported that on a public radio program, This American Life, there is a certain subculture of people whose prized possessions are their car stereos. They are called decibel drag racers. And people apparently from all different countries flock to competitions for this very purpose. And so I've never seen one of these, but I understand this is the way it works, kind of like a drag race. They line up all the dragsters in a line, and then I guess they basically turn on their stereos, and whoever has the loudest one wins. Now, these cars have been modified, as you can imagine, to win this competition. The world record holder at the time of this interview that I read about had 900 pounds of concrete poured into the floor of his vehicle. Now, I meant to ask the sound guys about this, but I forgot before I came up here. But I kind of get the reason for concrete, because I imagine the sound probably bounces off the concrete. But why would you need 900 pounds of it? That's what I don't understand. The windshields of these cars are specially designed, as you can imagine, but even they will only last about 3 competitions before they crack. That's how loud this noise is. And the funniest thing about this competition is that these cars are so loaded with equipment, there's no room for any people in them. You can't actually drive them anywhere. You can't take anybody anywhere because they just need all of that space for what they are going to use to project their sound. One reporter had an interesting insight as he was reflecting on this competition. He said this, "Everybody wants to be the king of a hill. But the number of aspiring kings always dwarfs the number of available hills. So in this country, we just make more hills. Hence, the decibel drag racers and the crazy competitions and the reality TV and so on and so forth. Everybody wants to be a winner. Everybody wants to be seen as great at something. It can be quite misleading. It can frankly be a little bit exhausting. And that's why I think it would be encouraging and uplifting and strengthening for our souls to take note today of what true greatness really looks like. And I think we see it in our passage today. So again, if you have your Bibles, we are in Romans chapter 10 today. And we're just going to do a few verses at the beginning of that chapter. Romans chapter 10, verse 1. Paul writes this: "Brothers and sisters, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved." Paul's primary concern at this point is the future of God's people and the hope that they will know the salvation that God offers. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a moment, but on the way there, it struck me that we should spend just a little bit of time on Paul's attitude toward the Jews here. Paul's heart for the people of God is that they will someday see heaven. He knows they are in danger of missing that because they have rejected the hope and access to heaven that is to be found only in Jesus Christ. And so his heart aches for these people. I personally find this striking. I find it truly remarkable because let's remember who these Jews are. They are the people who have rejected Christ. They are the ones who have sent Jesus to the cross, not them by themselves, but they were certainly part of that. The Jewish religious leaders are among those who persecuted Jesus and did all they could to disrupt and interrupt his ministry. And despite the fact that he came only to point them to God and to love them, they rejected Jesus' message of life and sent him to his death. And not only that, but consider the way they treated Paul. Not only are they striving to kill the one that Paul loves and serves, but they contradicted Paul, they argued against him, they reviled him, they spoke against his efforts to share Christ, they stirred up local congregations he visited, poisoned their minds against him, plotted to kill him, stoned him, and left him for dead. Paul would have every reason to fear and despise and hate these people. But instead, he prays for God's richest blessing for them. He prays for their salvation. Don't you find that amazing? Could you do that? This week, we're sadly marking the one-year anniversary of that terrible day when a shooter began walking down Danforth Avenue in the Greektown area of Toronto and began randomly firing into restaurants and businesses along that street, killing two people and wounding many others. In the light of that, Global News did a profile of one of the survivors of that attack. Daniel King was a nursing student, and she and her boyfriend, who is also a nurse in the ER, we're eating in an Italian restaurant on the Danforth on that day. As soon as they heard that people were hurt and bleeding, they rushed outside while most people were hiding inside to try to see if they could help those who were injured. As soon as they got out, Danielle made eye contact with the shooter and he fired immediately. The bullet tore through her stomach, shattered a portion of her spine. She spent 11 days in an ICU unit, has undergone 4 surgeries and is now on the long road of recovery, having been paralyzed from the waist down. She's had to move to a new space that is more suited for accessibility for her wheelchair. She's had to learn how to do basic things again, just like going up and down stairs. She suffers from chronic pain, physical pain, I'm sure, but also the emotional pain of being able to watch able-bodied people do all the things that once she was able to do and now cannot, and probably never will. And when you listen to Danielle, what strikes you is her attitude. She refuses to simply be a victim. I think we would agree she has every reason to feel sorry for herself, but, and I'm sure she has her moments, but she's also resolutely positive. She says that she's come a long way in 6 months, which is as long as she's been doing her therapy. She was a whole person before, and now she's ready to move on. And there's inspiration right there, but there's more. I don't know if Danielle is a believer. But of the shooter, she says this, I needed to forgive him because I don't have that energy to hate him. And she talks about wondering how much the shooter suffered in his life and how terrible it was that he didn't get the help that he needed. This is the guy that put her in a wheelchair for life, and she's worried about the pain he felt that prompted him to commit such a violent act. This, to me, is true greatness. If you're looking for it, there it is. It's in the heart of a Danielle who feels for her attacker. It's in the heart of an Apostle Paul who aches for the people who tried to kill him and longs for them to find heaven. And it's in the heart of Jesus who said, love your enemies, and who died for them. Would you be great? Would you be like Jesus? Then love the person who has hurt you. Let's keep reading. Verse 2. For I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Paul turns momentarily to another potential mark of greatness, namely zeal. That is, a great enthusiasm and a great action for something. Paul describes the Jews as those who have a zeal for God. And I think in this description, Paul's trying to be kind. He's about to illustrate why the people of God have missed this great salvation. But out of a mark of his love and concern, he wants to start with something positive. And so I think he says, these people have been zealous for God. And having zeal is not necessarily a bad thing. It can't be a good thing. King David in Psalm 69 cries out to God for help as his enemies are circling around him. David in that psalm is in deep waters, as he often was. He's exhausted. He pleads with God to deliver him from sinking into the mire, from the flood waters sweeping over him, from the deep swallowing him up as his enemies gather. And he declares in his defense his zeal for the house of the Lord. His argument is basically that he's given everything for God and his people, so he seeks God's help in return. And interestingly enough, Jesus' followers remember this idea of zeal for the house of God as Christ is cleansing the temple. So zeal can be a good thing, but it's not good here. And Paul says the reason it's not good is they have a zeal, but it's not according to knowledge. They've got great enthusiasm and energy, but it's not being directed by a proper understanding of God and His ways. Their zeal is really about following God's law, but not about seeking His grace. Back in the book of Acts, chapter 21, Paul is visiting James and the believers in Jerusalem, and James tells Paul about how the Jews were concerned that Paul was speaking against the law. See, the Jews thought that Paul was saying that the law was irrelevant. They heard what he was saying about Jesus, and they thought, well, what he's really saying here is, well, we don't need the law anymore. We just need Jesus. They thought Paul's teaching was designed to discard God's law. And so they got stirred up about that. And when they saw Paul in the temple, they wanted to kill him, and they would have killed him if it weren't for the Roman soldiers that were around there at the time and their intervention. The point for us to understand here, I think, is what motivated their zeal for the law. The law, you see, for the Jews and their adherence to it was their ticket to heaven. It was their way of attaining God's blessing and salvation. The law was what was going to get them close to God. And Paul, in their minds, was a threat to that if he was going to get rid of it. And what Paul is saying here in this letter is, yes, they were zealous for God and for His law, but they failed to understand or were ignorant of the fact that God's way of salvation was not going to come through them keeping the law. The law was not really their hope. If they were thinking that keeping the law was going to save them, they were wrong. Their knowledge was defective. And the takeaway from this, I think, is this. Zeal without proper understanding or knowledge is not good enough. Zeal must be grounded in God's objective spiritual truth and reality in order to be beneficial. In God's eyes, it's not enough to be enthusiastic or sincere or well-meaning or authentic in your belief. If that belief is not aligned with His truth and His morality. I wonder if you've noticed, our culture seems to be, I think today, fascinated with feelings and less with truth. It's about what you feel. As long as you really feel it, according to our culture, then that's okay. That's fine. And woe to the person that would challenge that, especially if it comes to spiritual beliefs. And maybe it's a function of our Canadian ethos. You know, we need to be nice to everyone. So you don't want to challenge anybody in what they think spiritually, because that might hurt their feelings. In our culture, it's actually preferable to affirm someone in their beliefs, even if those beliefs are wrong, rather than challenge them with the truth. We would rather support one another in our delusions than have a deep conversation about what is really real. And Paul would say, that is a recipe for disaster. Pastor Dan Meyer, in one of his sermons, talks about this memorable scene in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Indiana Jones is needing to cross this wide chasm in order to get to the other side, because on the other side there is this substance, this elixir or something that he needs to get to save his father's life. And there's this wide chasm, and he can't get across it. He rightly understands there's no human way that he's going to be able to jump to get across to the other side. But from behind him, his father, who's played by Sean Connery, yells at him, "You must believe, boy." And so, as if, you know, trying to do something he's never done before, Jones chokes out the words that he's heard other people say, and he says, it's a leap of faith. And clutching his hand to his chest, he stretches out one leg tentatively over the edge and takes a step. And his foot lands on a solid concrete bridge that he was not able to see while he was on top of the hill. And Meyer concludes this from that scene. It's not enough to just believe. We can never forget that the people who drove their planes on September the 11th had beliefs. They were very sincere in what they believed. People who built their houses on sand or invested in casinos instead of levees in New Orleans had a web of ideas that rationalized their actions. We all do. What we need, though, are beliefs that can really take our weight, that can allow us to cross the chasms that block us. We need good and true ideas, the kind of ideas that save lives. I think Meyer said it well, and Paul is saying the same thing here. It is not greatness just to be zealous, to be sold out to an idea. You must be zealous about the right thing. You must be zealous about what is true. Because only what is true can bear the weight of the reality we will face. So this begs the question then, well, how do we know what's true? Paul answers that question in his very next statement, verse 3. He says this, since they did not know the righteousness of God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. The source of truth then that we can be zealous for and give our hearts and energies to is God himself and his truth. The problem that the people of Israel have is that they've chosen to be zealous for a righteousness they cannot attain. They have chosen to pursue it in a way that is not defined by God. And they have, as a result, become ignorant of the very thing they seek. To be more specific, Paul is very clearly setting up a dichotomy here. He's trying to say there are only two kinds of righteousness, only two. One way is God's way. And the truth he has defined, it's the way that acknowledges that God is the author of righteousness. As Paul has said just a few verses earlier, the Gentiles did not pursue righteousness, have attained it by faith. In other words, they looked to God and they received it as a gift. Another way of saying this is that they've submitted to God's righteousness. They've come to see that it is God who makes us right for his kingdom. Right standing before God can only be a gift from the Almighty and Holy God. I like that way of thinking about it. If you want to receive God's righteousness, you have to submit to God's plan for that. I remember one fellow I used to talk to quite regularly back in another church that I was in. This fellow had an issue with this particular thing. He could not, for some reason, believe that Christ could die on a cross and that that would pay for our sin and that God could give us his righteousness through belief in that so that we could be acceptable to God. He just could not accept that. So he didn't think it was fair. I'm not sure exactly what the issue was. And it didn't seem to matter what I said, and I tried. And to me, it was a no-brainer. It's a gift. Just take it. But he couldn't. He just couldn't. And as I've reflected on that over the years, it's become my conviction that the problem he had was he just could not submit to God's way. He just would not submit. He would not accept God's determination of how this righteousness we need could be attained by us. He just wouldn't do it. But there's only two kinds of righteousness, and either you're going to receive it as a gift, Or, if you won't do that, then there's only other one option you have. You're going to have to try and manufacture it yourself. It's either one or the other. And the Jews tried to manufacture their own righteousness. And the way they did it was to cling to the law. Their conviction was that they had this amazing special thing that God had given them, namely God's law. And they had concluded that if we just follow this thing rigorously, if we just follow it to the letter, God will have to accept us. This is the way into heaven. And if we just work hard at it enough, we'll get there. But as Paul makes clear in the previous chapter, that will not work. It doesn't matter how much you know about the law. It doesn't matter how much you've memorized it or how hard you try to practice it. It will not help you keep it. You will fail in some place. We just do not have that ability. Having the law is not enough, knowing what it is. We're never going to get to the place where God looks at us and says, on our own, okay, you're good, you're in. But we try. We try. We want to believe we're succeeding at it. Have you ever heard anyone say, when you ask them, do you think you're going to heaven? They say, well, I think I've done enough. Or they say, well, I don't know, but I'm hoping by the time I get there, God will let me in. I hope I've done enough good things. Someone who says that is thinking exactly the way the Jews thought. That if we just do enough good things, we're going to make it in. God is going to look at us and we're going to say to him, God, I'm the kind of person you want in your heaven. You made the place for me. You need to let me in. Look at all these good things that I've done. The person that's thinking this way is in trouble. It's a righteousness obtained by works, and it simply will not work. And we see this all across our society over and over again. Recently, there was a survey that was done by a group of British researchers that tested this idea that people have that they're actually better than they really are, or think they're better than the average person. Does anybody here think they're a better driver than the average driver? Don't put your hand up. This particular test happened to survey 85 convicts in a prison and ask them about their pro-social traits. And the inmates were aged 18 to 34. They'd been jailed for various acts of violence. And as a result of the study, they concluded that compared with the average prisoner, they were more moral, kinder to others, more self-controlled, more law-abiding, more compassionate, more generous, more dependable, more trustworthy, and more honest. And remarkably, they also rated themselves as higher than the general population in their community, except for one thing, law-abiding. That was the only thing. Now, we might all laugh at that, but I'm telling you here today, you all do exactly the same thing. We all do. We all strive to look better than we are. We all think that we're better than we actually are. And of course, the ultimate example of justifying ourselves and promoting our own goodness is when, if we don't like God's law, we don't like something that God's law says, well, hey, we'll just make up our own law. We'll just rewrite it. And so you will find in our society today, mankind making up its own law, making up its own morality when it comes to sexuality, when it comes to our interactions with others, when it comes to our business ethics. You can just go on forever on the list. We know we need to be great, and we will get there somehow. And if we can't do it God's way, well, then we will just make up our own system and do it that way. And Paul wants his readers to understand that when God gave his law, He didn't give it so that we would have a checklist of things that we need to tick off so that once the list is complete, we can stand before God and say, hey, here I am, I'm good to go. What Paul wants the Romans and all of us to understand is that the law was given so that people could hear God's standard, and then they would fall to their knees in despair when they realize that God, if he wanted to, could throw every single one of us into hell and be totally justified in doing it. That's the purpose of the law. Now, if that offends you, that's actually good. Because it tells me that you're understanding what Paul was trying to say. If it makes you nervous, that's good. Because it tells me that God is working in your heart and helping you to understand that the righteousness that you need is something you can't manufacture by yourself. And if it leaves you hopeless, well, there's something good for that as well in this passage. Let's read the last verse for us today in verse 4. Paul says this, Christ is the culmination of the law so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. We are helpless in our ability to be right before God, but there is an answer. And Paul says that answer is Christ. He is the great righteousness that we need. Paul says that Christ is the end or the culmination of the law. What does he mean by that? Well, he may mean a couple of things. He could mean that Christ is the fulfillment of the law. Christ said that he came to not to disregard the law or discard it, but to fulfill it. And so there's a sense in which he's the culmination of the law, in that as he lived it perfectly. He was the perfect example of what it means to live a completely righteous life before God. So you could mean that, but it also could mean more like a termination. There's a sense in which when Christ came, he's now offered us, made possible something different for us than what the law made possible. The law showed us what we could not do. The law showed us where we would inevitably fail. But Christ in coming is the termination or the end of the law in the sense that that righteousness we couldn't get, he's now going to give to us by his grace and by faith. And so the blessing and the salvation that we may have sought before through keeping the law has now been replaced by receiving Christ and the offer of his righteousness. Righteousness and acceptance and blessing come from God, and they are available through him. And so we are now a people of hope, where before we had none. This is greatness. This is the great thing about the gospel, about the good news. This is what is truly, this is what we should celebrate as followers of Christ, that though we were lost, now we are found. Now we have a righteousness that can be attained as a gift if we would but believe in Jesus Christ. I'm going to stop there. And I'm going to encourage you to think about the great themes that we have seen here in this passage this morning. I hope that this passage has been food for your soul this morning. I hope that you've been thrilled to hear of Christ's great love and his great gift, how he has offered to make us righteous and acceptable to God through his own righteousness gifted to us. And it's at this point that I usually suggest one or two things that maybe you could be doing in the coming week to apply this particular passage. I'm actually not going to do that today, except to say this. Would you take some time, pull out your Bible this week, reread these verses, and let these spiritual truths just flood your soul? Think about what we've seen here this morning. Firstly, that true greatness means loving the unlovely, even those who have hurt you. That zeal is not a measure of greatness by itself. That it requires knowledge to be truly great. God's knowledge. That we are anything but great. That we cannot manufacture our righteousness for ourselves. But thanks be to God, nevertheless, though we cannot attain that righteousness, we know where to find it. We know the true greatness that is inherent in Jesus Christ as the one who came to offer us the way to heaven by accepting his righteousness as our own, as he gifts it to us through his sacrifice on the cross and through faith. Would you think on these things this week? Marvel at them. Let them flood your soul and your mind and your heart. And then, as for what to do with all of this, that's next Sunday. Let's pray.